Robert Plato. Welcome to this special podcast of Science Friday from sciencefriday.com. You're listening to Talk for the Nation, Science Friday. I'm Ira Plato. With thousands of people still trapped in the submerged city of New Orleans, millions still without power, water, and adequate shelter along the Gulf Coast, President Bush toured the devastation today, 5 hours after Hurricane Katrina struck. This hour, we're going to try to tackle some of the obvious but head-scratching questions about the situation in New Orleans and how it came to be that a major American city could exist and survive below sea level. We're going to look back a few years and try to answer the question, was this a disaster just waiting to happen, as some had predicted? We'll also talk about the public health risks that authorities are struggling to address, risks like disease, water shortages, health care, and what about the future of the city and the region? Can New Orleans be rebuilt so that the city could withstand future hurricanes without the fatal flooding that overcame it this week? Also, what role did the destruction of the natural resources, the wetland areas around the city, play in helping the hurricane? And finally, we are now entering one of the most active times of the hurricane season, especially for the Gulf of Mexico. We've already had two major hurricanes this year. The government is forecasting perhaps five or more of them. Think about the millions of people now homeless in the Gulf states, living in their cars or makeshift lean-tos or out in the open. How could they seek shelter if and when another hurricane or a few more of them happen to come along? What kind of planning should be going on now to protect all these people who are left homeless and out in the open? Give us a call. Our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. Let me introduce my guests. Ivor van Heerden is the director of the Center for the Study of Public Health Impacts of Hurricanes and deputy director of the Louisiana State University Hurricane Center. He's also associate professor of civil and environmental engineering at Louisiana State. He joins us by phone from campus in Baton Rouge. Thanks very much for talking with us today, Dr. van Heerden.
Thank you for this opportunity.
You're welcome. John Pardue is the Elizabeth Howe Stewart Professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering at Louisiana State. He's also the director of the Louisiana Water Resource Research Institute, and he joins us from the campus of LSU. Thank you for talking with us today, Dr. Pardue.
Thank you, Ara.
Craig Colton is professor of geography at Louisiana State University. He's the author of a new book, An Unnatural Metropolis, Wrestling New Orleans from Nature. He joins us by phone from Baton Rouge. Welcome to the program, Dr. Colton.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Let me just play on the title of your book, Wrestling New Orleans from Nature. Did nature wrestle back New Orleans this week?
Well, one little distinction there is wrestling New Orleans from nature. Down here we wrestle gators, but not the...
I'm sorry, it's resting. Well, did New Orleans rest it back? Did nature rest it back this week?
It took a big step in that direction, certainly. These kind of storms, New Orleans has suffered inundation before, river floods, hurricane floods, rainfall filling the bowl of the levees in the past. It's endured flooding on numerous occasions in the past. And each time the pumps have been able to, or even before there were pumps, the city has dried out and did move on.
Tell us how New Orleans got to be New Orleans, where it is. Why would you put a city under in a place where it's so vulnerable underwater, under sea level there?
Well, much of the city is not, most of the city, and particularly the place where people live, are not below sea level.
Mm-hmm.
The initial settlement clustered along a narrow ridge of land called the Natural Levee that even today is about 15 feet above sea level. The land generally graded back from there at a very imperceptible tilt towards the lake, which is essentially at sea level. And there's some other little high points and ridges within the city. But most of the city was not below sea level, and certainly where people lived was above sea level, and they chose to live there. They chose that site because, one, it was a great point for defending the great French interior from English the English who the French feared would want to take over their claim, and it was also a great place for serving as a port to export the goods from the interior of what was then France and what is now the United States.
Mm-hmm. When did the levee system, when did they decide they had to keep the ocean or the lake or the river out?
The first stage of levee building began in the 1720s. Actually, the first law for levee building was passed in 1728, which required every landowner to build a levee along their respective property lines that face the river. A more or less effective levee system along the river was in place by the 1860s, by the time of the Civil War. Only really in the 20th century did they begin building levees on the lakefront side. Mm-hmm. They had protected the city for the most part from river flooding, and they began getting a series of floods from the lake. They built levees there, and those have been increased in height over time, as have the riverfront levees. And now the entire city is ringed by a series of levee systems, and to augment those, they have to have pumps to pump the water out. Mm-hmm. Once the water's pumped out, much of the city has now subsided below sea level, but it was a wetland at one time. As the water was pumped out, they sink below. So the area below sea level has actually increased over time. And it is a fairly large section of the city.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, while I have an opportunity to talk to him, I want to bring in NPR correspondent Philip Davis, who is in Baton Rouge. Welcome to Science Friday. Philip, are you there?
Can you hear me?
Yes, I
yes,
can hear
I'm
you.
Here. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Are spirits any higher today now that the president has been visiting the area? At least, I know he's not coming to Baton Rouge, but to New Orleans and to the other Gulf areas?
Well, it looks like finally a pretty massive National Guard presence is finally making itself known on the streets in New Orleans. Just a little while ago, a huge convoy arrived in the city, heading directly for the convention center. And following behind them was another big convoy of buses that peeled off and went to the Superdome. And so, as one general put it, the cavalry seemingly has arrived. Combine that with the remarks that President Bush made today, I think you're going to see spirits rising a little bit, though, of course, it's still very early days.
Mm-hmm. And has the evacuation looked like it's begun in earnest and the law being restored to New Orleans now?
Law being restored, that is one question. I think it's a little early to start talking about that, but the evacuation looks like it has begun in earnest. As you know already, more than 11,000 people have been sent to Houston, and more are going to San Antonio and other cities. With these buses coming down, the evacuation has really started. As one state representative in Baton Rouge that I was talking today said, looks like the federal government has finally gotten it. And she sent out an appeal. You know, anyone who has a bus who wants to bring it down to New Orleans, you will now be able to get through. You'll be able to pick up refugees, and you'll be able to take them to refugee centers around the country. So this whole thing about blocking off New Orleans and not letting buses through, not letting help through, I think you're going to start seeing changes in that.
Mm. All right. Thank you very much for that update, NPR correspondent Philip Davis. Good luck to you.
Thanks a lot. Talk to you later.
You're welcome. We're talking this hour on Science Friday about what to expect in many different aspects of the Gulf region. We're talking with Ivor Van Heerden, John Pardue, and Craig Colton. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. Ivor, can a levee system, we were talking about the levees, the early levees, is there a model for a levee system that can be built that could withstand a giant hurricane of 4 or 5?
Yes, I think you could. You know, one of the difficulties in building levees in New Orleans, and Craig kind of pointed to this, is these are marshy soils. Mm-hmm. So you can't literally build a mountain of soil and hope for that to stay there. It's going to slowly subside. But the technology exists whether you use reinforced concrete or sheet piling and soil to build effective levees.
What are they doing in Amsterdam? How do they? I mean, they work seem to be surviving very well in their levee and dike system.
Well, if you remember, I mean, they did have a very serious flood in 1953, and lots of people. I think it was 53 or 57, and lots of people drowned. And they then rethought their whole levee system, and totally revamped them. And one important thing they've done is looked at tidal floodgates at the mouths of rivers as a way of cutting down surge.
Yeah, I noticed when I was there that they would open the gates up once or twice a day, something like that.
Yeah, we've advocated for some time now that perhaps we should build similar sorts of gates in parts of Louisiana. And if not, let's look at some of the critical cross-sections that the storm surge moves through and build, in essence, segmented breakwaters that would allow the normal daily tidal interchange, so we didn't interfere with the natural system and allowed marine organisms to move back and forth with the tides. But by reducing the cross-sectional area, we could reduce the amount of water getting in New Orleans and hopefully reduce the amount of surge.
Because we've heard questions about whether they should just start all over again in New Orleans. The president was asked today about rebuilding in New Orleans in the same spot. I guess if you build it the right way, they will come. They'll live there, and it'll be possible to safely go back.
Yes, I think there's a lot going for New Orleans. What I would argue for, though, is as you rebuild New Orleans, is to restore our coast. Because if we had those 1 million acres that we've lost since the 1930s, then the surge would have been a lot less. So that we've lost that outer protection, those wetlands and barrier islands that knock the surge down, and as a consequence, we get these Katrina-type floods.
Mm-hmm. John Pardue, would you agree with that?
I would agree. I think quantitatively our storm surge models really predicted what was going to happen, and I think that we have the models and the quantitative tools now to be able to show people that, hey, if we just had this structure here, if we just spent this amount of money, the storm surge would have been decreased by this amount. And I think it's time now to rethink where our priorities were and really start thinking more about what we can do coastal protection and trying to build some structures there to prevent this from happening in the future.
1-800-989-8255. Let me go first and ask about the water that is left. I guess, would it be fair to say that where the water is in New Orleans, the New Orleans become part of the lake, basically, with the breaches in the dike and the levees over there? Dr. Pardue.
I think that's the case. The water is, again, slowed because the lake level and the water level in the city have come to some equalization now. So until we pump that water out, you're correct, the city is part of the lake at this point.
And what health dangers does that pose? Or you know, people, when they see water, they immediately think, uh-oh, mosquitoes.
Well, mosquitoes, we have a West Nile problem here, and that's probably more of a secondary issue down in the weeks ahead. But, of course, that water has permeated the homes, the businesses that are in that central area bound by the levees. And so any chemicals or any other toxins that were present on the streets or in the homes or in those businesses have now, of course, seeped out into that flood water. And in addition, the sewer system's compromised. So we any kind of viral or bacterial pathogens that were in the sewer at the time of this disaster are now in the water as well. So those chemical issues and those public health microbial issues are probably, I think, the two health threats that are compound to just the high water itself.
We were talking about restoring the levees and actually making it's possible to build levees that would be functional. But we've been hearing from you and from other experts about having to restore the wetlands and how that might have been able to mitigate some of the storm surge. How do you go about restoring all that land that is missing?
Well, I think that the two things. One is you have to create some diversions in the Mississippi River to allow that natural flow of sediment during the spring floods every year to get out and nourish that wetland and keep it from as it subsides and keep it alive. And then we're going to have to do a second thing, which is much more difficult, an engineering problem, which is we've got to get large quantities of sediment into these areas that are subsiding and just rebuild the wetland, much as they've rebuilt areas in Holland, as you mentioned before.
Speaking of which, let me ask Dr. Van Heerden, what about the, I mentioned before, the water and the possibilities of diseases. What other kinds of diseases, the longer the water sits there, can we expect?
Well, obviously anything organic in there is going to start fermenting and putrefying very rapidly. So our initial concern is gastrointestinal diseases. Dr. Pardue mentioned West Nile. We believe probably a few weeks from now we'll see quite a large increase in the numbers. Just imagine being one of those folk on their roofs. The mosquitoes will be tearing them apart every night. Additionally, we're concerned about other mosquito-borne diseases, the principal one being St. Louis encephalitis. And then there's secondary concerns. The local raccoon population is a carrier of rabies. These animals are going to be looking for shelter and food just as the humans are. and there's a potential of them biting humans or biting pets. Obviously, snakes are a big problem. And then we do have a fairly recent immigrant known as the fire ant. It's a very aggressive ant, has a very painful bite. If you get enough bites, you know, you could suffer. So all of that combined, and then, you know, right now there are two big fires in New Orleans. One of them is apparently at a chemical facility. There's a pipeline that seems to have burst, and there's a fire burning at it. So air contamination, anybody who's asthmatic or has respiratory problems is probably right now feeling it.
What about the refugees who are in the other Gulf states? We saw with the devastation in Biloxi, other places, who are basically living in lean-tos or possibly an old abandoned anything that they can find. Are they facing the same threat, the health threats?
Similar, but, you know, they don't have the standing contaminated water problem that we do in New Orleans. So their problem is a little bit different.
1-800-989-8255 is the number. Let's go to Mucher in Memphis. Hi.
Hi. How are you, Ira?
Hi.
Great show, as always. Issue here, I'm chairman of an emerging institute at FAMU for the state of Florida. We're doing a public-private partnership, a Semitech type of deal for hurricane-proof construction standards and mold-proof housing. And a big problem that I found, also as a retired Global Marsh McLennan partner that ran catastrophe and construction, is that when you go and talk to public officials, it doesn't make any difference whether they're Democrat or Republican, that we cannot get them to be serious about public infrastructure in the United States across the board. And they see us as alarmist. And we have these fabulous academics there, all of which who have given papers and presented ideas, and they've been basically ignored. And, of course, the politicians say, well, we just, you know, our people don't want to pay taxes. And in states like Tennessee, we don't even have a state income tax. So, I mean, this is really a question for the American people. What do they want to do? Do they want to have quality of life and some kind of shared European model where you have world-class infrastructure, but you just want to have decaying infrastructure and the attendant risks that we're living with now? I mean, that's really, really the question. The final issue is the private sector willing to become what I would call responsible collaborators? In the construction industry, it takes 20 years to get them to do anything. And yet in Europe and Finland, they have tons of stuff that'll stand 200-mile-an-hour winds. It's very efficient in pricing, et cetera. The Canadians have technology. There's tons of stuff out there. It's not, things don't even have to be invented. I mean, it's there.
But just getting somebody to, getting a public official who you'll say, they'll say to you perhaps, what are the odds this is going to happen? You'll say 1 in 6,000.
Right.
And then, well, why should I spend all that money on 1 in 6,000? And then, bam, 1 in 6,000 happens.
That's exactly right. And so now the hope is for all of the collaborators here and across the country is when we come forward, will anyone really be listening or will they write this off as, well, this is the one thing that'll ever happen? Because, of course, they're ignoring the whole global warming phenomena and the increasing preponderance for natural disaster in this hemisphere.
Let me get some Ivory, any reaction to that?
My feeling is that the government's going to pay a whole lot more attention to academia after this because, you know, we called this and we've been calling it for a number of years. I think we've been right on with every one of the impacts. I don't think we expected as much violence, but I think maybe now, you know, government will see us as a resource rather than a bunch of geeks trying to get research dollars. You know, New Orleans could be, and certainly, you know, academia is going to try their hardest to be part of it. New Orleans could be the beginning of a new approach to, you know, how we deal with inner city problems, how do we deal with good drainage, how do we deal with a reasonable road infrastructure. And in terms of private industry, they have taken a huge hit with this financial hit. Whether you're insurance, manufacturing, oil and gas, you name it, they've all taken a huge hit. And I think this may be what gels them to take a different approach in the future.
Mm-hmm. Craig Colton, in hurricanes of the past that have hit New Orleans, are usually the same people over and over again the ones who get smashed?
Well, in general, there's been a long-standing pattern of those people with the least resources being the most impacted. Those people have changed over time because, for example, in the Great Flood of 1849, the impoverished immigrants of the day were the Irish, and they lived in the low areas. They suffered terribly during the 2 or 3 months that it took to drain the city then. The African Americans were enslaved at that time. They generally lived in and amidst the neighborhoods where their masters lived, and they generally were on the high ground. Today, the low-income population is largely, not entirely, but largely African American, and they have found themselves living in the least expensive quarters, the least expensive properties, which tends to be, in many cases, the lowest or ill-drained neighborhoods. And so there has been a consistent pattern of low-income populations being most susceptible to flooding and suffering the most in the long run.
Hmm. There's a saying in the West that water flows towards money. That isn't the case in New Orleans, is it?
No, I like to say that in New Orleans, water flows away from money, and those with power and resources tend to live on have the greatest choice about where they live. They can live on this band of higher ground on the natural levee. They have great influence in the political structure to help make sure the higher ground is adequately drained. Those people with the least resources and the least voice in politics tend to suffer. Now, in New Orleans, it must be emphasized that there's been an African-American administration in the mayor's office for around 20 years. They have a majority, a population in the city. They have a voice, and there have been attempts to improve the drainage system in African-American neighborhoods. It's a slow, gradual process, and even with heavy rainfalls, there's still flooding in some quarters in New Orleans.
1-800-989-8255. Miriam in Madison, hi. Welcome
hi.
To Science Friday.
I have to say that I agree in some ways with the gentleman from Memphis. I have to say that I'm one of those horrible government officials. Government only has as much authority as people are willing to give it. And when you're talking about levies, you can get slammed from both the left and the right because property rights people don't want you to take their property, and they don't want you to tell them what they can and can't do on their property, mm-hmm. they're building in the coast. But the environmental impacts of building levees are incredible, so you're going to have the environmentalists screaming at you. Government only has as much money as people are willing to give it. These things are expensive. Structural responses are extremely expensive when you're looking at flooding. And the focus of where the government goes, that comes from people. And I think it's really fascinating that no one's brought up the shift that occurred within the Federal Emergency Management Agency and the government as a whole after 9/11. You can get dollars like you wouldn't believe for terrorist stuff.
Right.
But you try to get dollars to go out and do an acquisition of a flood home at risk to flooding, it's really impossible. It's difficult. It's extremely difficult. And, no one's talking about that.
Well, there actually have been news reports about the Army Corps of Engineers having had its money for the levees diverted by the government to...
It's not just that. The USGS runs a river gauge system throughout the United States, and that is constantly being cut. There are gauges throughout the U.S. that are being dropped, and these are things that have historical records going back 40, 50 years, and no one's there to pick up that because nobody has any money because there's money always needing to go someplace else. And how are we going to predict? How are we going to be able to make sure that we make good choices for people? Because there's an awful lot of people. I think Mike Brown was correct in some of the things that he said in the last couple of days. People make choices about where they live. I will admit, the people who are poor, who have limited incomes, it's extremely difficult for them. But when you're looking at the Gulfport to Biloxi area, you did not need to put those casinos on the river, on the waterfront. And I am extremely bothered by some of the stuff that I'm seeing because those homes shouldn't have been there in many cases.
Mm. Let me just remind everybody that I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. And you have people building on floodplains all over America, not just in Biloxi.
Yes, because the National Flood Insurance Program does not tell you cannot build someplace. They simply tell you, if you're going to build here, you must build to certain standards. But those standards are minimum standards. There's no guarantee that you're going to be safe. Yet people constantly, the most expensive property in certain parts of the United States is the coast. You look at New England. You look at Florida. You had four hurricanes come through last year, but they're still having a building boom down there. I mean, people do not make rational decisions.
Do you think that this hurricane is going to change those minds?
No. Oh,
no.
People want to be on the coast. They think it's wonderful. They think it's wonderful to be near water. They don't think it's going to happen to them. But if you look at the insurance statistics, you stand a 26% chance of having a claim made on a house in the floodplain with a mortgage over a 30-year period. Mm-hmm.
And coming full circle, though, the people who are most affected by this one, at least in New Orleans, are the people who are certainly not living on those giant, beautiful homes overlooking
the ocean.
New
Orleans is a very different case. I mean, it's first of all, it's an extremely old city. You can't get people to move from where their sense of place is. But when you look at the new construction that is occurring in the coastal and floodplain areas in the United States, it's truly appalling.
Where do you work in the government?
I currently am working for the state of Wisconsin. I've worked for the state of Massachusetts, and I got my my big foot in the water was in 1993 in St. Charles, Missouri, which is the confluence of the Mississippi and Missouri rivers.
So do you think that you're bringing actually a pessimistic viewpoint here is that no matter how bad something is, we're going to forget it. You know, like Martin Luther King said, we're a 10-day nation. And when those geeks go back, these scientists, as we were talking about before, and give you the data and ask for the money, they're not going to get it again anyhow.
Well, you know, it's what we're willing to pay for. It's what are we willing to give up to pay for that? There's only so many dollars that are available to a government, and there's lots of places that it has to go. And you have to sit there and do calculated risks. Mm-hmm. And that's what the Corps does, and that's what people do every day. I think you're going to have some people who are going to decide, no, they won't go back. I think you're going to have some places that, yes, they may disappear, which you saw after the 1993 floods mm-hmm. in the Mississippi Basin. But you're going to have a lot of people who are going to go back, and you're going to have a lot of people who say, hey, land's cheap. Let's go buy some.
All right. Thanks for calling. Good luck to you.
All right. Bye.
1-800-989-8255, which brings up a question I was thinking of. Ask my guests, Ivor Van Heerden, John Pardue, and Craig Colton. Let's say you drain out New Orleans, and I don't know how many weeks or months it's going to take, and people want to go back to their homes. You've shored up the levees. The water has been stopped. Is it a safe thing to tell people to do, knowing that the next hurricane could start it all over again? What do you do as public policy? If you haven't, you know, fixed everything up, you've just put the Band-Aids on, knowing that you're, again, living on something that may be borrowed time.
Looking at historical precedent, after Hurricane Betsy in 1965, people immediately went back to the flooded neighborhoods. They were crawling out of roofs just exactly as they were in this flood, mm-hmm. not over as big an area. But people moved back in, and then they then slowly began the planning process to upgrade the levees along the lakefront to basically where they are now. So they responded. It took 20-plus years, 30 years, but they did move right back in, and people lived with the risk.
Mm-hmm. But they should – they're willing – we give them the option that they're willing to go back there. I mean, do insurance companies come in and say, I'm not going to insure you if you live here anymore?
That was before the National Flood Insurance Program. Actually, a lot of the housing stock in the Bywater area that was damaged in Betsy, we did an inventory. Something like 80% of the housing stock is still in use. Mm-hmm. Part of the situation in New Orleans is some of these older homes built with cypress, raised on raised piers, are pretty floodproof.
Yeah.
And they weren't, because there wasn't a wall of water, as in Waveland, there wasn't a storm surge, it was just slowly rising water, the houses were restorable.
Mm-hmm.
Well, but that's not true for all houses in New Orleans, mind you.
Talking about the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, all my guests are from Louisiana State University. Ivor Van Heerden, John Pardue, and Dr. Craig Colton, who is also author of A Natural Metropolis, Wresting New Orleans from Nature. Our number 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to the phones and see what some people have to say. Kyle in Portland, Oregon. Hi, Kyle.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I got a curiosity. Y'all been talking about putting the levees back up and restoring the wetlands and all that type of thing. I'm coming at it from a different point of view. Let nature take its course. You can't fight Mother Nature. Leave the water there. Take out the levees. turn New Orleans into another Venice, Italy, instead of Amsterdam.
Ivor, what do you think of that?
Well, the problem is that, you know, Venice is a series of you know, 5, 6, 7-story buildings, and the lower stories are flooded. In New Orleans, and a lot of those are apartments, and in New Orleans, most of the houses right now are underwater. Those houses, you can imagine, New Orleans experienced hurricane-force winds for 10 to 12 hours. The buildings were damaged, a lot of them pretty severely, and now they've flooded, some above their roofs. They're going to be flooded for weeks and weeks and weeks. You know, those buildings are going to be totally uninhabitable, and, you know, will probably have to be torn down and rebuilt before folk can go back.
You think just about all the water buildings that are in, you know, more than a foot or two of water are going to have to be torn down?
Well, you know, we don't have an idea yet of the full contamination in the water, but the potential is that the interior wall spaces could be sucking up all kinds of chemical materials, such that, you know, the contamination would be higher than what would be healthy to live in.
Has any city on this scale had to be pumped out the way this one will have to be, or drained?
I think parts of the Netherlands after the 1950s big flood, they had to pump it out. But a lot of that was farmland, not as well developed. You know, this is a vibrant, full city, and with industrial areas as well as residential. So different story, different picture.
They're talking about opening the levees in strategic places to drain the water out. Does that sound like it would work to you?
It'll get the water level down to the equivalent of Lake Pontchartrain, and Lake Pontchartrain is generally a foot above sea level. We've got a cold front approaching in a few days. With a cold front's approach, we have strong southerly winds that builds up the level in Lake Pontchartrain. So yes, it'll be effective to some extent, but one thing that's not been spoken about, when you put those contaminated waters into Lake Pontchartrain, you potentially are going to hammer the marine resources. So one hopes that the powers-to-be are thinking about compensating, you know, those, say, oyster fishermen and shrimp fishermen who may suffer as a consequence.
Well, so speaking of that, let me ask all three of you. Maybe you know the answer to this. What about the possibility of we haven't talked about the Gulf and the oil that may be seeping out of wellheads there. Is there a possibility that could be happening? We've seen these rigs just washing up on shore. John Pardue, what's happening to the oil pipeline they were attached to?
Well, we do have a large spill today from a 2 million gallon series of tanks in Venice that was observed via aerial flyover about 6 or 8 hours ago, a large spill. And so spill response has already begun on that process. And generally when these storms come through, we do have spills that occur. But to give the oil companies credit, I mean, I think that for the amount of infrastructure that they have there, it is relatively spill-proof with regard to these kind of storm events.
Mm-hmm. What does a hurricane do to all the, you know, the tremendous fisheries, the shrimp industry, and all the other fisheries that are in the Gulf? Do they revive it? Do they rejuvenate it? Do they turn it? It's a natural occurring thing for them to be expecting, you know, to go through this kind of cycle?
This is Ivor. As a sports fisherman, I've always found sports fishing pretty good after a hurricane's been through. So I think they can adjust. You do see some fish kills, principally from perhaps those caught in the rough surf.
What other people were mentioning that there are other natural disasters concerning hurricanes that may be waiting to happen, and they point to the Florida Keys. Being that Route 1, if you drive down there, you know how skinny the Keys are. You know how crowded Route 1 that goes down to the bottom of the Keys would present as a nightmare for evacuation. Are people thinking about these things now?
I think they are. I think that, you know, as forecasting improves, it gives us more and more time to order the evacuation. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, one thing we used in Louisiana was the contraflow, the idea of turning the bridges or interstates in both directions out. I'm not sure whether they do that at Key West, but certainly we know a lot more about how fast we can get people out, and the forecasting has improved so that we can have a better sense of the track of the storm.
And let me ask another what-if question to you, Ivor. Maybe you're the right person. We're now entering one of the peak times of the hurricane season. And the weather folks are predicting another possibly two or three major hurricanes. What happens if one another one comes right through the Gulf while the Gulf is so vulnerable, meaning the people there?
Well, obviously, the catastrophe will only increase beyond. It's beyond almost beyond description right now, and it certainly will. New Orleans is flooded, so there couldn't be too much more damage. But obviously, there are a lot of people who don't have homes. In Baton Rouge alone, the population has doubled in the last two and a half days. And a lot of those folk are sleeping out in the open or, you know, in under lean-tos and stuff. So, yes, if we got another hurricane, it would be devastating, and we're not at the peak of the season yet.
And that's why I'm talking about, you know, we've been talking about what-if scenarios and how people don't pay attention to the geeks, the scientists who predict what if these things might happen. Aren't we in one of those now? What if another hurricane comes through? Aren't there and shouldn't there be people thinking about that? What do we do with the million or 2 million people who are without homes up and down the coast?
Well, you know, I mean, we've advocated for years that the federal government should look into the building of you know, a refugee camp in situations like this. And one potential way to deal with all these evacuees out of New Orleans, and there's still potentially another 100,000 to be rescued. And then, you know, the 400,000 that are in Baton Rouge and other places would be to house them in safe refugee camps outside of the potential of the, you know, the surf zone, where you can address their needs, get schools going, get the normality, get clinics, medical clinics, counselors, you know, everything that's needed to so folk would have some sense of normality in their lives and some protection from the next hurricane.
You haven't heard, you don't sound like you've met with a good reception to this idea.
Well, I heard, I believe it was the Secretary of Homeland Security last night admitting that, you know, they need to start looking at this. But when we brought this up in exercises in the past, the response from FEMA and the person that we were talking to about housing was Americans don't live in tents. So, you know, maybe the attitude will change now. You know, the unfortunate thing, the goodwill in Baton Rouge towards the refugees is eroding very rapidly because we've had some violence. And that is terrible, but that's the reality, and one's going to have to address that.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, the real estate agents are not keen to say, move down here, we have a great refugee camp in case the storms hit.
Yeah.
1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Carl in Oakland. Hi, Carl.
Hi.
Hi there.
I live about 2 or 3 miles from the Hayward earthquake fault. And that has a potential for disaster very comparable to the New Orleans situation. And so people know about it, and there's some preparation, but it's, you know, when it cuts loose, it's going to be a massive disaster. If we're lucky, it won't be as big a disaster as New Orleans and the Gulf Coast, but it'll be a big disaster. And
yet, you people choosing to live there, like you.
Absolutely, it's home.
Yeah, I get it.
And it's a wonderful place, and all kinds of cool people around here. It's frightfully expensive.
Thanks for calling 1-800-989. We could talk that say that about just a lot of places in America. Kathy in Nashville. Hi, Kathy.
Hi there.
Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Yes, I'm actually from New Orleans and driving through Nashville and caught your program on the radio.
So what part of New Orleans are you from?
I'm from Uptown New Orleans, and I actually know Dr. Van Skirten. This is Kathy Shea's wife.
Oh, hi.
How you doing? And Shea stayed in New Orleans. My husband stayed in New Orleans until yesterday. We live up near Tulane University. Our house doesn't have any water but sustained heavy roof damage. But I really called to talk about the working coast and the oil and gas business and how there is so little perception across the country of the importance of Louisiana's coastline to the oil and gas industry and fisheries. I don't think people have a clue. I mean, maybe they're going to learn from this storm, and I don't know how much you discussed this before. It's just incredible when you look at just even the small piece of coastline that I manage for a living. Percentage of both imported and domestic production that comes through that area.
It's an incredibly important part, and we're gonna learn in the next few weeks by you don't know how important something is until you don't have it.
Right.
By not having a lot of stuff that goes through there.
Well, I mean, I don't know what the impacts were down there, and maybe these gentlemen can clue me in, particularly down at Fouchon, what the impacts were, and also give me an idea of how quickly they think the oil and gas industry down there will recover.
Can I ask you a question or two first, Kathy?
Yes, absolutely.
You said you got out, and what day did you leave?
I left in the middle of the night, Saturday night, went to Natchitoches, Louisiana, mm-hmm. and stayed in a hotel for 4 days. I'm with my dog and my teenage daughter, and we are headed to Annapolis, Maryland to get her in school up there and get my mom, my 82-year-old mother, who was in Chicago over there, and then I'll return to Baton Rouge if my husband can secure housing there.
So do you know how destroyed your home was or how much damage?
Just heavy roof damage, trees down, water inside from rain, but no flooding. The flood waters stopped about 2 blocks from our house, and my husband had a generator and stayed there, but was said getting out of town yesterday. He rode his bike around for several days, but getting out of town yesterday was one of the most frightening experiences he's ever had.
Hang on there, Kathy. I'm going to get an answer to your question after I remind everybody that this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Let me ask my guests, how important is the Gulf? What is the state down there of the oil industry and the other kinds of resources that are down there? Ivor, can you fill us in?
We those are some of the things we're trying to find out. There's not a whole lot of information coming in. ExxonMobil, I've been in discussion with them, and we're going to be talking with some of the public relations folk. But, I think there's been a lot of damage. There's just a report now of a second oil spill off the Chandler Islands, which is the east side of Louisiana. We've seen that there's a pipeline within New Orleans, and New Orleans is crisscrossed by major pipelines that carry product. One of these appears to have been ruptured. So my guess is we're in for a long, maybe as much as 6 months before we get back to full production.
Yeah. Any word on Loop?
Loop is popping again, Kathy.
It is.
It is. Yeah.
Tell us what Loop is for we non-New Orleans.
Loop is a pipeline that is an offshore loading facility that loads a very large percentage of the nation's oil and carries it onshore for the refineries through these wetlands that we talked about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 1.2 million barrels a day.
The president said Continental pipelines, is that the right term, was pumping the over 47%. It was supposed to be 47 is higher, he said. He didn't give us a number, no facts. Good luck to you, Kathy.
Can I just tell Kathy, yes. I got a message to Shay and said you guys can come stay with me if you want.
Well, thank you. He's there now staying with Karen Ramsey and Walker.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay.
Thank you.
Right.
Good luck.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
1-800-989-8255. This oil spill, can you give us a direction that it's maybe traveling? Is it headed toward the Gulf or is it contained or what would these spills affect?
The one on the, I don't know about the location of the one on at Venice, but the one on the Chandler Islands is a few miles offshore, and I'm not sure which way it's moving. They've just detected it with satellite imagery.
Mm-hmm. Would this be something that might affect the shrimp industry or other kinds of wildlife?
Well, I think it depends on, if it gets, if it stays out in open water or if it was to wash ashore and get into the marshes. But, yes, this could have a significant impact on some of the wildlife resources of Louisiana.
Mm-hmm. So we only have a short time left. Let me have you sum up, Dr. Calton, as someone who looks at this historically. You think the city will recover? You think that this is just another story in its life?
Well, I think this is truly a momentous turning point. This is a moment in New Orleans history that there is not a precedent for. I think the city will remain a city. I think it's going to take a very different form. I think it's time for some really sensible thinking about how to incorporate a lot of flood-proofing kind of ideas into the planning and not just relying on a structural means for flood protection. Mm-hmm. But I think it's truly a remarkable turning point. I think the music will survive. I think the culinary arts will survive. I think the historic architecture will survive, as reports are coming out that it has. Mm-hmm. But many, many aspects of New Orleans, the society and the economy, are certainly going to be altered in I think, really, ways that we can't conceive just yet.
All right. I want to thank you for summing up for us. Craig Colton, professor of geography at LSU, author of the new book, An Unnatural Metropolis, Wresting New Orleans from Nature. John Pardue, director of the Louisiana Water Resources Research Institute, professor of civil and environmental engineering at LSU. Ivor Van Heerden, director of the Center for the Study of Public Health Impacts of Hurricanes and deputy director of the LSU Hurricane Center. Thank you all, gentlemen, for taking time on a busy day from your work.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. Remember to visit sciencefriday.com for more information on this topic and every topic we talk about on Science Friday. See you next time. I'm Ira Flatow.